material to less dangerous stuff. Kidneys operate primarily as filters, getting rid of excessive dissolved solids in the fluids in your body and such. They get rid of urea, which is a breakdown product of proteins. They get rid of salt and potassium, depending upon electrolyte balance that you have, so that you always have the proper balance of potassium and sodium. So it's more of a filter system. If you think of a kind of a glorified super-duper version of a funnel with some filter paper, and then it runs serum, blood serum through it, and what comes out goes into your bladder. So it's not really processing poisons in the cells. It's just filtering them out of your intravascular space.
Comment?
Yeah, but what happens if it gets clogged up in this?
Well, then you get kidney stones, and that's very painful. Brian, you wanted to say something?
Just two things. Going back to the progeria, you were mentioning about DNA whittling down. One, are you referring to telomeres?
Yes.
Okay, and the second question is that if you're drinking cranberry juice, wouldn't it be just as effective as to go ahead and have just taking a couple of vitamin C tablets diluted in water?
Well, you got a couple little problems with vitamin C. It depends upon, of course, the quantity. Vitamin C can and has crystallized in people's bladders and given them bladder stones, kidney stones, and other such. Whereas cranberry juice doesn't do that. So if you keep the concentration of the vitamin C relatively low, there's less of a risk. But with cranberry juice, you don't have any risk.
Isn't the acid in cranberry juice the same as ascorbic acid, or is it different?
Right. No, it's the same, but it's the concentration that counts. You could take massive concentrations in the form of pills that you probably couldn't shove that many cranberries down your throat.
That makes sense. I understand. Okay. No, I'm fine. Thank you for answering my questions. I'll be on the side.
Okay. Back to you, David.
Tell me, what's the difference between cranberry extract and cranberry juice?
I would assume the cranberry extract would have a lot of the fluid removed. You know, the extract could be 0% water, or it could be 1% water, or 5% water, whereas the juice is probably something like 80% water.
Well, they have this product you can buy on Amazon or eBay, which is cranberry juice, but super concentrated. So you can put like a little bit in a cup, and then you add the water to it, and it's as strong as regular cranberry juice.
Okay, I mean, that's sort of like instant coffee and such. You can dehydrate a lot of things and have most of their characteristics survive and then rehydrate them. And, you know, I mean, they do that with laundry detergent all the time. You know, you buy concentrates and you're supposed to top it off with some regular water, and it saves plastic containers, volumes can be cut back significantly because everyone has a source of water, thankfully, to dilute whatever thing has to be diluted.
Comment.
WA2VSN.
Yeah. Let's see. WA2ZFF.
Good evening. WA2VSN. Hello, Roy. I understand that with regard to renal colic, there are benefits derived from drinking cranberry juice, not just the amount of ascorbic acid or vitamin C. What is your take?
Well, there might be. I was kind of alluding more to the generally used benefit of people with chronic cystitis and infections and such. But there, you know, it's a complex organic matrix of ingredients, so it can have other effects as well. Just the easy to answer reason of why it's so good for people with cystitis and infections is simply that the acidic medium is kind of inhibits cell growth of bacteria.
Okay, I appreciate that clarification. I just don't think that taking vitamin C, be it simply ascorbic acid tablets or otherwise, is a good way to prevent renal colic. I think obviously the primary way or methodology is simply sufficient hydration.
Okay, I wasn't suggesting vitamin C. Unfortunately, Linus Pauling kind of put his reputation in the toilet by over-promoting vitamin C for almost every other thing. So I certainly wouldn't have suggested it and don't plan on in the future.
Okay, I would agree with the reasonable degree of medical certainty that what you say is in concert with my understanding. Okay, back to you. Thank you very much, WATVFF.
Okay, very good. I think Brian wanted to say something.
Well, there's two things. First of all, no need to go ahead and necessarily go on Amazon and shell out lots of money for something where you don't know about the purity. I know that I've seen frozen cranberry juice concentrate, like orange juice concentrate and grapefruit concentrate in the supermarket in the frozen section. And you could reconstitute that. But the question is, you know, how much of a concentration is too much concentration, and how much ascorbic acid is too much versus, you know, over what period, over a longer period of time? What's the general consensus as to the dose, even in a product such as cranberry juice, so you don't go ahead and overdo it?
Wow, that's another interesting question that I don't really know. The problem with some people is that more is always better, and more is definitely not better in medicine. There are proper dosages for medications. As far as food supplements, if you keep it rational, you know, I wouldn't suggest having the equivalent of 10 glasses of cranberry juice a day. I think you're kind of asking for something strange to happen. So, I mean, you know, just make the dosage have sense. You know, a couple of glasses a day is probably suffices. And if you want it concentrated or not concentrated, again, that's up to the individual. Is there a possibility that some aspects of cranberry juice are more effective when the cranberry juice is relatively fresh, and the processing might cause some deterioration of some other aspects of it? I don't know. The problem is that food supplements is a multi-billion dollar industry that people peddle all kinds of questionable and not so questionable food additives all the time, and you know, often ultimately all you get out of it is very expensive urine. But you know, if you can afford it and if it's relatively safe dosages, usually water-based vitamin supplements and such, you can't really go terribly wrong. I mean, you can give yourself kidney stones and other kind of problems, but water-based vitamins and such usually are relatively safe. Oil-based vitamins, on the other hand, can cause a lot of problems if you take mega dosages, as people started to do about 20 years ago and got into a lot of trouble.
What is the primary method of excretion or the half-life of ascorbic acid? Is it metabolized by the liver? Is it metabolized by other means?
I think it's it's used in metabolism for construction of things, but ultimately, if you take too much ascorbic acid, you urinate it out. That's the problem. You get ascorbic acid crystals growing in your bladder.
Ah, I understand. Okay, so basically, you have to go ahead and watch. It seems like a combination of things. You know, water intake and amount of ascorbic acid in the cranberry juice, and you don't want to exceed too much. So, like you said, the 2 glasses a day is enough to go ahead and have the same effect. That's fine. I just wanted to know about, the potential pitfalls of going ahead and perhaps saying, oh, maybe I should take some more, et cetera, et cetera. You know, is this going to go ahead and help me? Because I don't really see what cranberry juice has in it that could really make you feel much stronger, aside from basically acidifying the urine and giving you a few extra calories.
Yeah, I personally, I don't know if it may just be a reaction that that David has in particular, but there's nothing inherently superpower-inducing on the part of cranberry juice. It has some sugars, which give you some energy, but a lot of fruits have sugars that would probably give you about the same amount of energy. So I can't really tell you what the nature of cranberry juice giving people energy is. The concept of something giving you energy, though, is a very kind of loose it depends on if you believe it's going to give you energy, then it's a lot more likely to give you energy. So it might be an aspect of a placebo effect, which is a very useful effect. It has benefits. You know, but it has the most benefits to the supplement industry.
And what happens if you're hypoglycemic? That might help, right?
Kidneys. If they are not functioning well, can that be a bottleneck for other organs in the body?
I'll answer David, and we'll get back to Brian after David. Kidney failure can kill you. As I said before, kidneys serve two major purposes. They deal in fluid and electrolyte balance. If your electrolytes are out of balance, your electrolytes are the means for a lot of neurological functions. Your heart could stop. If your sodium and potassium concentrations are completely screwed up. But also, it does get rid of a lot of poisons that are dissolved in your blood plasma. It doesn't really metabolize at the kidneys, but it does. It acts as a means to extract concentrations of deleterious metabolites from your body, like I mentioned urea. Urea is turns into urine, the yellow stuff, the urochrome, and it's a process from the metabolism of proteins. And if you weren't able to clear the urea out of your body using your kidneys, it would build up and poison your body. You'd start to get this yellow pale. You'd start to sweat urea crystals. And, like I said before, a lot of people have died due to kidney failure because kidney function is incredibly important to maintain homeostasis, equilibrium of life.
WA2VSM?
Yes, Stu?
In my reading, cranberry juice is filled with various antioxidants, none of which are found in vitamin C. It also has nutrients that are extremely beneficial, whereas none of these nutrients are contained in vitamin C. So you can't make a comparison between the two, for example.
Yeah, and I mentioned that earlier, that one is just a single chemical, and the other one is a very complicated organic matrix of all manner of stuff that has yet to really been figured out. And unfortunately, antioxidants as a group is one of those nebulous things that a lot of people kind of throw back, forth, and center. And yet there are no real definitive great studies that signify that an antioxidant of one type versus another has any particular benefit versus the other. But, yeah, things like cranberry juice are complicated combinations of things. And so you're not just dealing with one molecular structure. So, yeah, I agree with that. I mentioned that earlier.
Okay, thank you for that clarification, Roy.
Okay, I think, Brian, you had something to say?
Oh, no, I agree with the other gentleman, absolutely. It is a complex combination of all kinds of things, all kinds of complex substances and, you know, in juices, whether it be cranberry juice, blueberry juice, apple juice. There's always things in there. I guess the way to look at it as a whole is that if you consume these things in reason, and you watch your diet and, you know, your weight and certain other hereditary factors. And if you make it to past 100, maybe you have the right formula. But also, you know, mental state has a lot to do with it, too, and, you know, outlook on life. It's so complicated. It really is. I mean, I couldn't even fathom.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's a matter of luck. Sometimes it's a matter of genetics. Sometimes it's what you eat. It's probably a combination of everything, but probably mostly luck. You know, I mean, you have the yogurt commercials with the people, you know, in East Europe who lived supposedly. They're all from villages where there's no such thing as birth certificates, so they can say whatever their age is. But, you know, the commercials were something like, she's 142 years old and she eats yogurt every day, so eat yogurt and live to be 147.
Oh, the old Dan and yoga commercials. I remember that when I was young. Yeah. Bagua Tapagua of some country in East Uzbekistan or something like that, whatever it was at that time. Yeah, I remember that as well. But, you know, I think my wife's uncle, he passed away at 104, and he was ambulatory pretty much all the way to the end. It was amazing how many times he fell and his attitude in life. He didn't break any bones. It's amazing, okay, how he rebounded for everything and what a different, a positive outlook on life that he had was just like, I don't know, almost like a karma in order to give him that extra boost, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, emotional stress has an effect on the human body, and if you have a good attitude, you tend to shake off emotional stress a little bit better than people who dwell upon it. The worst that you could, psychological way of looking at the universe is to just kind of dwell on every problem or misstep that anyone took towards you in your entire life and just carry it around like real heavy baggage. So I think that's probably why there's some degree of correlation between people with good attitudes and relatively healthy lives are. But, you know, that's just conjecture on my part.
I'm just going to make one last comment, and then I'm going to free the frequency up for other people. Do you believe in caloric restriction?
Theoretically, it's an interesting thing. They've experimented on rats, and it does extend their lives. They haven't really done significant studies on human beings for obvious reasons, so it might be of benefit. The problem is human beings kind of, to a degree, know what's good for them and what's not good for them, and 99% of them maybe. Kind of make excuses to do things that they know aren't healthy. So, you know, you could put that on the list of things that are healthier for you. And the American people have become a population of morbidly obese people, unfortunately, and probably equally due to the food industry as human nature.
And with those comments, which are much greatly appreciated, I will remain on the side. Thank you.
NYD with a comment.
Yes, please. Yes, someone wanted to make a comment.
So, health benefits. What are your thoughts about that? I've been enjoying the conversation.
Ah, thank you.
What are your thoughts about turmeric?
Say again, you're breaking up.
About turmeric.
Oh, I don't know. The problem is that there's a near infinite number of miracle ingredients out there that are being promoted by people. Most, if they have any kind of research behind them, their research that's paid by companies that make a lot of money promoting them, so they're not very reputable. It might be great. I have no way of knowing because I have no independent studies to demonstrate whether they're great or not.
Okay, just checking in. First time on the repeater. I'm here in New Jersey on Route 287. I've got a lousy signal. So I'll say 73. Keep on, keep up with the good work. I don't know how my signal is, but the name is Robert, K-A-2-N-Y-B.
Okay, Robert, your last transmission was better. What happens is apparently you kind of jump out of the repeater every so often. So this time you were on in the repeater the whole transmission. Previous ones, about a third of the time, not so good. So, but welcome to our repeater. Welcome to our net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m., and you're welcome to join us. If you have a problem communicating via radio, we have EchoLink, we have AllStarLink, we have all kinds of links. So you're welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. I'm on a hill right now. I can see Manhattan and I'm going down. Good. No problem on the radio. I'm just kind of far away. Sometimes I have a problem remembering how to get home, but that's a story for another time. Hi, hi. 73, happy holidays and a very safe and healthy New Year to everybody. K-A-2-N-Y-B.
Thank you. You too. Stay safe. Be well. 73. David, we're coming up to 10:25, so I think we're going to have to call it in to this particular portion of the technical net. I'm sorry we never got to the questions that you wanted to ask. Like I emailed you, the best approach is try as best you can to kind of come on at the top of the technical net, get your name on there, even if it's not first. You know, Wes is very flexible, and we can make adjustments, but you have to come early.
Not a problem. It was very interesting talking about these supplements and kidneys functioning. So I guess it's okay. Maybe I'll take these supplements for a couple of months and then, you know, I can stop taking them.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, none of these things are addictive. So, you know, if you decide to stop, it shouldn't cause any significant side effects. So I wish you well. You know, like I said, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, and almost everyone takes food supplements of one kind or another. At the very least, they have very expensive urine, and I'm sure some of the supplements are actually doing something. So I thank you for your participation, as always, David, and I look forward to future sessions on the technical net.
QSL, and all other people also getting a lot from this 73KG2RY. Oh, by the way, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and Happy New Year.
Thank you, David, and to yourself and your family. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year. A lot of things to be happy about. Anyway, it's been loads of fun. I hope you guys were entertained and informed. You learned a few things, and hope you'll join me next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. And now it's time for full WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
The 73
ACTGS WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Very good. The topic's tight. I feel healthy already listening to you guys. Anyway, as far as what's new with the space program, there were two satellites that were just launched by India, but for the European Space Agency. They use a Polar satellite vehicle, launch vehicle, PSLV, out of India. And this is called the Proba 3. And I mentioned this last week, and a week before, I think it was, where they were going to launch it, and they finally did launch this thing. It's actually two satellites in one. One has a chronosphere, corona sphere. I'm looking for the word. Anyway, it's a big shield that goes out. In this case, around 4 feet in diameter, which will block the sun. And then the main satellite is about a football field behind it, and that thing will be looking at the sun corona. You'll get a 6-hour solar eclipse out of it every time they do an orbit. The orbit takes about 20 hours to go around, but it's out of those 20 hours they get 6 hours of solar eclipse time. It's an extremely high inclination orbit of 37,000 miles apogee and only 350 miles perigee. So it's a big ratio, and apparently they did some testing already, and it looks like it's going to work. We'll keep an eye on that program anyway. Anyway, I just wanted to see if anybody had any quick comments or questions that they were thinking about before I go on.
One question from KF2ZV.
K2ZZ, is that? No, I don't think I have that right. Kilo 2, no. What's the call again? I just listened to you, but I didn't get the call when you were...
It's okay, it's Brian, Kilo Foxtrot 2 Zulu, KF2ZZ.
Okay, Brian, yeah, very good. KF2ZZ. Very good. And Michael is WS2N. And again, name here is Paul for the SpaceNet report. What's your question, Brian?
Well, Paul, I'm very curious. With all these Starlink satellites that Elon Musk has put into orbit, have any of those interfered with launches or other scientific observations or anything in terms of communications that would be detrimental or, perhaps injurious to any spacecraft?
Yeah, out of the 7,000 that they put up there, none have really interfered with anything else as of yet. Some of them were no good, and they automatically deorbit themselves. They have these ion thrusters on them. They're called HAL ion thrusters, you know, which slowly deorbits them if they need to, or also keeps them in a proper orbit. And they've deorbited quite a few of them over the years. But yeah, the biggest problem with them was the earliest satellites were a bit reflective, which was really done by the astronomy people. The next group that went up, they put kind of let's call it a black paint, some kind of a paint that would absorb any kind of the light. That was probably the only big problem that they've had so far. But they have a plan, you know, another 20,000 of these things to eventually go up. And someday it could be a problem. They're higher than the space station. You know, space station 250 miles up, with most of these satellites on 350 miles high or a little higher. So, you know, that is not really a problem. But, you know, it all has to be considered when you launch anything first, you know, where all these satellites are. And there's other ones, of course, too, by other countries. You know, I think there's something like 10,000 active satellites in Earth orbit right now. That's not the big problem. There's around 100,000 things that are floating around in Earth orbit that are bigger than 10 centimeters, which is anything 4 inches or larger, has the ability to be tracked, so there's 100,000 items that are being tracked. So that's all considered, and every time they do a launch, we'll put something else into orbit, Brian. Back to you.
I copy that. I find it amazing. They must have vast computer systems that are capable of constantly going ahead and taking this data and basically putting it through a strainer and making sure that any launch doesn't interfere with those particular objects.
Yeah, that's right. NORAD is really responsible for safety of, you know, our country's infrastructure. So, I guess they have supercomputers running this stuff all over, you know, on a regular basis. And I guess they could be accessed not only by, you know, our military, but, you know, the private companies that launch as well. So I'm sure that's all checked out before they have a launch and put something else into orbit. Anyway, let me get down my list here. I just want to talk about a couple of other topics, Brian.
Oh, thank you very much for answering my questions. I appreciate it.
Okay, yeah, it could be a problem in the future with all these satellites. Like I said, SpaceX wants to put another 20,000 or so Starlink satellites up. Amazon, Jeff Bezos, he wants to launch over 3,000 communication satellites, you know, for the internet to compete with SpaceX. And he should be launching a next group early next year. He's already got just two experimental ones in orbit now. But then there's, you know, there's China. China just a couple of days ago, they launched their first group of internet satellites. And they plan on, well, you know, the first couple went up, they're called Gouan, G-U-O WANG Internet satellites. And the Gullwing system is going to consist of over 13,000 satellites. So, you know, you got 30,000 here, 13,000 there, 3,000 there. You already have one web is up there. They have around 600 doing the same thing right now. So it's getting crowded. Any comments?
This is Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. Paul, Mr. Charles.
Charlie, good evening. How you doing? And over to you, AJU. WS1.
I'm doing fine. Last night, I'm sorry I left it abruptly. I was ill.
Really? That's not good. Did you get over it, or... So not whatever it is.
Yeah, it's something I had from Burger King. It'll teach me to go there.
Oh, I love Burger King. I was just there today. That's the best. But I always get the same thing, so maybe you get something different. I don't know. Yeah, that's a shame. You know, it is what it is, you know. You buy stuff from the supermarket, you know. You just hit it at the wrong time. But anyway, you're following the space program in the last week.
Go ahead, because you wanted to talk about something.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I was just mentioning the Gullwing satellites by China. And their eventual plan of over 13,000 was launched by a Long March 5B rocket, one of the atomic ones that they used. They launched it from the Wangchang launch complex. You know, they have like five different places to launch satellites in China. So, you know, they're doing one right after the other lately. You know, I know we're over 100, of course, in the United States this year, but they're up there. I think they did 68 satellites. 68 launches, which translates into sometimes multiple satellites at the same time. So, you know, hundreds of satellites by China are now in orbit that weren't in orbit last year. So it is getting crowded up there. To go back to Brian's comment, it's very crowded in orbit. There's another spacecraft, Bepi Colombo. I covered this, when it launched back in 2018, and here it is, six or seven years later, and the spacecraft is destined to eventually orbit Mercury, so it's called the Bepi Colombo. It's really two spacecraft in one, mainly European Space Agency, that's the main one, and then they have a supplement one built by JAXA, you know, the Japanese Space Agency. They were launched together on an Ariane 5 rocket back in 2018, and it's a long trip to get to Mercury, believe it or not. The idea is actually to, in a sense, slow the spacecraft down to eventually get into an orbit around Mercury. Mercury has an orbit of about 88 days around the sun, so they have to, you know, get the orbit down to Mercury's orbit. That they need, even though it was a small spacecraft, a couple thousand pounds, they needed a big rocket to change the speed of that thing. To go from Earth orbit to Mercury orbit is actually a very time-consuming process. to go around Earth. Gravity assists a couple of times, and then Venus a couple of times, and then Mercury around a half a dozen times over the years to eventually get the thing into orbit. I believe it's November of 2026. I just read the other day. And when they do that, that will be the second time the spacecraft has orbited Mercury. First time was way back in the 1990s with the Magellan mission that NASA launched to Mercury. And that was a successful orbiting the spacecraft. But, now European Space Agency and Japan plan on basically duplicating that with of course, much more modern equipment, instruments on board to look at that planet. So, yeah. Any comments?
Well, I think that, you know, astrophysics is really quite fascinating to me. This is Brian, KF2ZZ, and I've always had a long-standing interest in it, and it's amazing what they could do with gravity, both as an assist and also as a repulsion.
Yeah, it all depends on how they approach the planet that they're trying to utilize the gravity. You know, we have a couple of them that are on the way to Jupiter. European Space Agency has one called JUICE. We have one called the Europa Clipper. And when it passes Earth, you know, in other words, it gets launched around the sun, you know, slightly more elliptical orbit than Earth. And when it comes all the way around the sun, it comes back to Earth again. It picks up speed. Sometimes they pick up, you know, maybe 8,000 miles per hour difference. You know, it's already going maybe, you know, 25,000 miles per hour just to get away from Earth in the first place. And then it eventually works its way around the sun and picks up another 8,000 miles every time it gets near Earth. Or another planet. But then they'll do the same thing if Mars is in the right location. You know, when it gets out near Mars, they'll do the same thing. And, you know, so that's the way they've been doing this while. I guess it's the Voyager days back in the 1970s. And actually before that with Pioneer 10 and 11 went outside of the solar system as well. They needed the big planets for gravity assist. But yeah, without it, you could do it, but you would just need a massive rocket bigger than anything that we've built so far to do something like that. The New Horizons, that didn't use any gravity assist. Just used the Delta IV rockets. They had three of them bolted together, so it was called the Delta IV Heavy. Put the New Horizon on top of that and just blasted it the heck out of Earth. And to give you an idea, to get to around where the orbit of the Moon is for New Horizon, you know, New Horizon's goal was eventually to get to Pluto. Just to pass, when it passed the orbit of the Moon, 250,000 miles out, it only took 9 hours. 9 hours. So that big rocket was really hauling. But it could do it because it was a light payload. You remember the Apollo astronauts, when they went to the Moon, it took them 3.5 days. Get to the Moon. But, you know, that's for other reasons. They had plans of actually going into orbit. But here this thing, New Horizon, went past the orbit of the moon in 9 hours. And it didn't use, I don't think it used any of the other planets for gravity assist. I might be wrong, but I think they might have used Mars. I'll have to check on that one. But that thing is still functioning. Did its job. It got out all the way to Pluto without really looking at Uranus or Neptune. They were like in the wrong location at the time. It was strictly a Pluto mission. But after Pluto, it kept going, and they used it to find a Kuiper belt object, which it did, and took pictures of that, and it's still going. You know, in case it comes across something else, it's still functioning. It does have a nuclear RTG on board, radio isotope thermoelectric generated, you know, to power it. Doesn't have any solar panels. It'll be similar to the two Voyager missions. They're the same thing, too. They're powered by nukes as well. Any comments?
Well, got a question.
Sure, Charlie. Go right ahead.
On Saturday, they scrubbed the mission, but they never told you why.
Yeah, I mean, NASA has done that too, because they didn't have the reason for NASA, you know, over the years, over the decades. And then, you know, sometimes they have the reason right away, you know, weather or, you know, the range isn't that clear. That means, you know, a ship is out at sea that is in the area where the rocket might be going. You know, they'll delay a mission or something like that. They'll let you know. But if it's a technical problem and they don't know what that is, you know, eventually when NASA, yeah, they will tell you. Might be a day, might be a week. But you know, we always get an answer. You know, we pay for NASA. But the SpaceX one that you're talking about, it might come out, it might not. You know, they're private companies, and we'll see if it's something common like the weather. You know, high upper winds going 150 mile an hour jet stream that they don't want to go through. At the time, you know, they'll let us know. But yeah, I think that was another stalling mission by SpaceX. I think that's the one. Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, and these satellites will be up at 22,000 miles in the gastrostationary orbit. What's wrong with lower Earth orbit?
Oh, was that a synchronous flight that was canceled? I didn't. I'll have to check. But yeah, some satellites go up to the geosynchronous satellite area, 23,000 miles above the Earth. And some satellites go at 250 miles above the Earth, where the International Space Station is. And some of them go to around 350 miles an hour, 350 miles high, where the Starlink missions are. And then you take the GPS satellites that we all use. They're all around 11,000, you know, roughly half the distance between here and the geosynchronous location. Geosynchronous is designed to sit in one spot, usually near the equator, and looking down at Earth. And as the Earth goes around, the satellites go around. And, you know, at that distance, it takes the satellite 24 hours to go all the way around from one location to another. same as the Earth. So it's looking down at the Earth, and they can get this, you know, the all the information from that, looking down at, you know, communication satellite. It'll work for the United States, you know, 24 hours a day. You know, if it's a weather satellite, again, you know, stare down and look at a hurricane 24 hours a day. When it gets to nighttime, you know, they could use all their infrared technology, and they can still look at it. And that's the reason they do that. Communications. Same thing. We have the TDRS satellites in the geosynchronous orbits as well. There's 11 of them now. And they're called Tracking Data Relay Satellite System, TDRS. And NASA put them up there. They started back in the 80s. In fact, one of the first ones that was going to be put up was by the Challenger mission. You know, the Challenger that blew up. That was a planned TDRS satellite. And over the years, they've put a bunch of them up there. I think there's a total of 11. And they can communicate with a lot of the NASA stuff. Hubble will transmit up to a TDRS satellite and then back down to Earth. And this way they could look at a satellite, you know, 24 hours a day. Anyway, back to you, Charlie. That's the main purpose of geosynchronous.
I just wanted else to tell you, SpaceX plans to ring this weekend for the 91st launch of the year. That's just SpaceX. Wow. That's phenomenal, because you got other companies out there who are doing it, other countries that are doing it.
I mean, they're very close to a monopoly. But we have Firefly doing it. They launched a couple of launches. The Electron has been launched by Rocket Lab and quite a few times, I think. Since 2017, they've launched, you know, almost 60 launches. They now launch not only from New Zealand, but Rocket Lab launches the Electron rocket from Virginia. So, the NASA flights aren't that many, but they're always very dramatic. They've launched the two Vulcan rockets. Their new heavy lift vehicles this year, two of them. We have the SLS, of course, Space Launch System. We haven't launched it this year. The last time that launched was December of 2022. That's the one that will eventually launch people to the moon. A lot of stuff being launched. European Space Agency. They have the Ariane 6 launch vehicle now. That's now replacing the Ariane 5, the heavy lift vehicles. I mentioned one earlier in the net, the Apollo launch vehicle by India. They also have the geosynchronous launch vehicle. They have a heavy lift vehicle that, of course, puts satellites into either geosynchronous orbit, or they could do an interplanetary mission. India has done that. They've launched a spacecraft to the moon, actually landed on the moon. India has also sent an orbital spacecraft to Mars. So, a lot of stuff going up, Charlie. You're right about that. Back to you.
Okay, I'll choose these.
I got one more to... Let me see, 63 years ago today, Atlas LV-3 from General Dynamics, they launched in Florida, December 22nd, 1961. Still putting satellites up 63 years later.
Oh, yeah. Well, first Atlas, you know, it changed over the years. You know, the early one was the first orbital satellites that we used, manned space, John Glenn and the other you know, early astronauts would launch on the you know, Atlas rocket. Eventually, that became the. They switched over to the Titan rocket for the Gemini program. I heard a comment. Another station. Is that Brian or somebody else?
This is Brian Cast2ZZ with a comment. You know, it's amazing when you look at the SLS, which is basically, you know, what they call Apollo on steroids. Basically, you're taking a little capsule, and the whole entire rocket is fuel. So the question is, has any progress been made on the atomic level to go ahead and use a different type of propulsion rather than reliance on chemical rockets?
Yeah, well, I mean, early in the program, space program, they were developing a nuclear propulsion system. The nuclear heat would heat, they would store liquid hydrogen on board, and it would heat the liquid hydrogen so hard it would force it out. And theoretically, they never did it, but that would have been a vehicle that could have gotten off the Earth. They called it the Nerva program, I think it was. Anyway, that capability has never changed. So we've been using chemical rockets to do that. What's changed is the orbital vehicles. You take Starlink, and once they get into orbit, they use ion thrusters to push themselves along. Very, very low thrust, but you know the engine never seems to shut off. You know, you could leave it on for years, and you could accelerate to different locations. That was not developed by them. It was developed by NASA and the European Space Agency. First ion thruster was a spacecraft called SMART. Went off, orbited the moon. That was European Space Agency. And then we had the Dawn spacecraft, which eventually went into orbit around the asteroid Ceres, and eventually another asteroid. The amazing thing with that is, you know, it had such a great ISP. ISP is like, you know, a rating for gas mileage. Number was so high that you could have this Dawn spacecraft go all the way out to go into orbit around Ceres and actually de-orbit around Ceres.
I understand what you're saying.
And
I remember that as well. But the next
around the other
step
satellite
is to go ahead and have a
the other
atomic
asteroid
type rocket.
So we have that capability.
That gives a exhaust that is, of course, completely non-deadly radioactive, because the chemical rockets are woefully, you know, it's crazy. You need something on the atomic level that's going to give off a tremendous amount of energy that's going to be able to go ahead and lift a vehicle into orbit.
Accelerated to your heart's desire. You know, you turn these things on, and you know, years later, they're still running. The thrust is so little, it's about the weight of a couple of pieces of paper on your hand. But you just leave that on all the time, and even if it's a couple of thousand pound spacecraft, eventually that thing will start, will accelerate to the speed that you need. So it's an amazing capability, and there's so many spacecraft like that now. To go to geosynchronous orbit, a lot of these spacecraft now, they'll launch with the chemical rocket, you know, and get into orbit, and then the next stage will turn on with these ion engines. And it might take you 3 weeks or a month or 2 months sometimes to get into geosynchronous orbit, you know, with a chemical rocket, yeah. But